Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome, welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival Spiritual Corner. My name's Wes Nisker, and this is my friend, my teacher, my benefactor, Jack Kornfield. And we're here partly on the occasion of his publication of yet another, no doubt, bestseller. No doubt. Really wonderful to be here with all of you. Feels very, very Berkeley in here. Very, I feel very comfortable. So I want to start, Jack, with a little reading from your book. In fact, the very first sentences. Dear friends, after more than 40 years teaching mindfulness and compassion to thousands on the spiritual path, the most important message I can offer is this. You don't have to wait to be free. You don't have to postpone being happy. So let's do it.
Right now.
Yeah, right now. Why not? There's no time like the present. Title of the book. I'll keep reminding you. Let's do it. Want to lead a little guided meditation with the people here?
Sure. Let's sit for a minute or two or three. 3 minutes, they say, is enough to get enlightened if you do it right, because you're already enlightened. Anyway, let yourself sit comfortably. Feel your body seated on the chair, feet on the earth. Some sense of both presence and ease. And if you like, you can let your eyes close gently. Take a couple or a few deep breaths. And feel how the body just breathes itself after you take the deep breaths. Come back to its natural breath rhythm, and you're interbreathing with the winds that touch the eucalyptus trees on the Berkeley campus and that came fluttering over the Golden Gate Bridge to your lungs and that dusted the tops of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa on its way over the Pacific. After dusting the tops of the Fukushima nuclear reactor and all the trees in Siberia, you're interbreathing with life, you're interbreathing with the earth. And relax with each breath. And as Thich Nhat Hanh would recommend, try placing a half smile on your lips, sitting with ease, breathing in calm, breathing out ease. Let the body and mind settle. And let the heart soften as well to hold this whole human life, yours and all those around you, with tenderness and compassion. When you're ready, stay with the sense of presence and ease and let your eyes open. And just come back to notice what's around you, but now somehow with a centered and more present attention. Not trying to go anywhere, but just to be exactly where we are in this mysterious human life. Let the mind quiet and the eyes open and the heart open. Say, here we are. So extraordinary. How did you get in there, you know? Really? When you think about it, you were this tiny little embryo, a couple little cells coming together and grew, and you were then in your mother's womb, and you came out. What a wild way to get to be a human being. Here we are, another one, okay. Little kid growing up, and so forth. And when you look in the mirror, the amazing thing is that even though your body's aged, you know, loses its fur, droops, and Wes says the hard parts become soft and the soft parts become hard. It's his description of it. The weird thing is that you don't feel older, right? Everybody know that experience? You look and say, huh, how did that happen? Mm. And that's because it's only your body that ages. It goes from being a little child to an adolescent, a young adult, and older, until it ages and eventually dies. But the moment that you say, don't necessarily feel older, that's because the consciousness, the awareness, the witnessing is outside of time. It's the spirit that was born into your body when you were tiny, when you were first conceived. And it's the spirit that will leave your body afterward, and you'll float out of your body into some light and say, wow, that was an amazing one, wasn't it, that incarnation? You wait, you'll see. And the beautiful thing is when you remember this, and meditation and the invitation of this book is really just to remember who you are. As Nelson Mandela experienced walking out of 27 years of Robben Island prison with such magnanimity and graciousness and a spirit of both forgiveness and courage, that they can put your body in prison, but no one can imprison your spirit. Because that's who you are, really. And so the freedom that's invited, whether it's through spiritual practices of different kinds or just the deep wisdom that we know, is always here for you. And there's no other place to find it than where you are.
Beautiful. Your voice, both on paper and in the flesh, is made for teaching meditation.
Sleep, yes. Yes, it's poppies just out of the Wizard of Oz. That's right.
I'm wondering if it was, you talked about reincarnation there. We've had this ongoing dialogue as to whether there is such a thing. And I always tell Jack that I used to believe in reincarnation, but that was in a previous life. But you say in the book, as I remember, that you used to believe in nothing, and now you believe in everything.
Yes.
Could you expand on
Elaborate?
That?
When I first went to live in the forest jungle monasteries as a young man, because I'd read all these amazing books about Zen masters and enlightenment and all that stuff, and I thought, gee, I wonder if they still exist. And so it was during the Vietnam War period, and I didn't really want to go and shoot at people. So I asked the Peace Corps to send me to a Buddhist country, thinking I could find some master or some place to study. And fortunately, they sent me to Thailand, and I spent 2 years working on tropical medicine teams on the border of Laos and Thailand and Cambodia in that area during the wartime. And there was battles in the provinces I was in, but we got to do something that was helpful to people there.
What year was that?
1967. And I found this wonderful teacher, and went to the monastery, and I said, you know, I don't necessarily believe all this whole Buddhist cosmology thing, realms and birth and death and multiple lifetimes, you know. I come from a family of scientists. And he looked back and he says, oh, don't believe it. It doesn't matter. You don't need to believe any of that. I said, really? He said, yeah, because birth and death take place all the time, with every breath, with every moment. What was past is gone. What's new reappears. Your day, your life is born every morning at breakfast. He would look at me and say, and all that you need to learn about life can be learned in the present moment, exactly where you are, because the rest is a fantasy. The past is gone. It's a memory. The future is a fantasy. If you're interested in anything real, and it doesn't mean you can't plan or care for things, but you do it in the present. If you're interested in love, love in the past is a memory. And love in the future is some kind of ideal fantasy. Maybe I'll find it if I go online to the right site, right? Or something like that. But the only place you can really love, a child, you know, the environment, someone you care about, the community around you, is exactly where you are. So he said, forget all that other stuff. So I didn't believe in anything. But then all kinds of weird things started to happen. I remember doing a long retreat, 500-day retreat, silent, sitting, walking in meditation in this little hut in the jungle. And the first time I had out-of-the-body experiences, I was so tired, and I lay down to sleep on the wooden floor. And I got up and I walked out to the little porch in my hut, and I turned around, looked inside, and there was someone in there. I thought, that's really weird, and they're sleeping on my floor, you know? I looked around, I could see all this other stuff, and I walked back in, and it was me. I said, oh, I knew I wanted to get up, but my body just didn't go along with the program. And I started to have all kinds of experiences like that, and memories of other lives, which may or may not be true. It wasn't like Cleopatra. It was like being a monk in some old Chinese monastery where I had to work in the kitchen, you know, and take out the garbage. But then more things happened, as happens to us as human beings, because life is actually so mysterious. When my youngest brother's wife died, Esther, I was with them quite a lot toward the end of her life, and she was getting very close to dying. I'd gone home to sleep, and then I wanted to hurry back to be there, but I had to stop at the drugstore on the way home. On the way there, rather, in the morning, I got up early, stopped at the drugstore, and I'm hurrying through the line and get to the cashier, and all of a sudden, my body just softens. And I says, oh, Esther died. And I got out to the car and I called my brother. I said, so, hi, how are things going? He said, oh, Esther died 5 minutes ago. And I said, I know. How many people have had that kind of experience here? Yeah, a third of you already. I mean, I've been with people in Asia and they know that something happened to someone in their family. And then, you know, they get the message, it happened at that time and that way and that day. How could that be? Because we really are connected. We're not just physical experience, but what's true is we are also consciousness. And to know that, like Nelson Mandela discovered, or Aung San Suu Kyi in her, what she described to us when we visited and talked with her, her 17-year retreat, she said, and oddly enough, she was reading some of the Dharma teachings from Western teachers in her retreat. She must have been really bored. I don't know, you know, poor girl. But anyway, the reality of this mystery is always around us, and we take it for granted. And sitting with people in hospice, they come very close to die, they float out of their body, see lights and so forth, and sometimes they come back for a little bit, you know, sort of the in and out process, and describe it. How was it? Oh God, it was so peaceful, light, love, and so forth. As one of my good friends who had that experience, He said, you know, it's not at all frightening what I thought it was. It turns out to be very different than that. So I don't expect anyone to believe anything of this. This isn't the point of it at all. But if you can't go out and lie on the grass at night and look, when I was a kid, I used to lie on the grass, look up at the stars, but I would pretend that I was on the bottom of the earth, because it doesn't have a top and bottom, you know, really. That's just arbitrary. And that gravity was like a big magnet holding me there so I wouldn't fall down. And I would look down into the sea of stars, which gave a little kind of thrill. But how did we get here and who are we? So the point of meditation isn't to make yourself a better person. You've tried that already, and, you know, therapy and dieting and, you know, and it helps a little bit, but you're still as weird as when you started, basically. You know that's true. It's not to perfect yourself, but it's to perfect your love, to be able to be present for this life and all that you care about in a very different way than we ordinarily would do in a modern, addicted, consumer society, to kind of wake up from that and see something that's much more mysterious and magnificent and beautiful.
That's so wonderful. There's a passage I want to read to you, but in a moment, I just want to follow up by saying that I think all of the Buddhist teaching can be summarized in a knock-knock joke. The disciples come to the master and they say,
knock, knock.
And the master answers with the number one spiritual question, who's there? And if you don't get the joke, you have to be reborn over and over again until you do get it. Staying a little bit, going back a little bit in your life, were there any circumstances or conditions or events that you remember that kind of started you on a spiritual path that made you want to try to find the answer to these questions?
Try to do it in brief. Part of it was just the pain and suffering in my family. My father was a scientist and in certain ways quite brilliant. But in other ways, he was quite disturbed. He was violent, abusive, a wife batterer. My mother used to have to wear long sleeves in the summers to not show the black and blue marks when he would throw her around. He would come home and you'd never know whether he would attack us with violence or whether he wouldn't. So when I was in college and I heard this wonderful old professor, Wing Sit Chan, from Harvard, sat actually cross-legged on the desk a couple of times, and he lectured about Lao Tzu and the Buddha. And speaking of the Buddha, he said, there's suffering in this world. Anybody not notice that? There's causes for it, greed, hatred, ignorance, which promote violence and racism and all the terrible sufferings that humans can make. And there's an end to it, and there's a path to the end to it. And I sat up and I said, okay, this is something I need to learn about for my own life, for some kind of healing, but also because it felt like the most important question we could ask. How can we live in a way that promotes happiness and well-being instead of violence and conflict and suffering? That was a big turning point. That and coming to the Summer of Love and dropping acid. I mean, come on, let's get real. How many of you? Never mind. I saw you there. I know. I remember you. I saw you at Golden Gate Park. Yeah.
you had put your precepts on hold at that time, right?
I don't consider that against the Buddhist precepts. It says to not take intoxicating substances that lead you to heedlessness, because then you can create all kinds of suffering. Led me to awareness. It was, yeah, hey, give me more of that. That's good stuff. But also, you know, at least on my mother's side, well, all right, let's tell that Ram Dass story. Ram Dass, who's a close friend of ours, and Wes and Ram Dass were studying in India back in 1970 and with other colleagues of ours. When he came back, he was Baba Ram Dass, and he had a long beard and beads and, you know, white clothes, and he was sort of teaching his spiritual thing.
Jerry Rubin called him Baba Black Sheep.
So a woman sitting in the front row after he was teaching for a while said, Ram Dass, Ram Dass, all this Hindu stuff you're teaching, aren't you Jewish? Come on. And Ram Dass says, well, yes, I am. He was bar mitzvahed as I was, you know. And she says, well, what about the Jewish path? And he says, I love the Hasidic, the tales of the Hasidic masters are like Zen masters, and the Kabbalah has all these wonderful teachings about the levels of consciousness and so forth. So it's beautiful. He said, I love that teaching. And then he looked out and he said, but remember, I'm only Jewish on my parents' side. Okay. And there was something very wise and witty in that remark, because who you are is not just your parents or not just your culture, thank God, or Buddha or whoever that is, right? That who you are is that spirit that was born into your body. And the stories in this book and the teachings are really freedom to start over no matter where you are, freedom to let go of the past, freedom to be true to yourself, to dream, to engage in the world, and freedom beyond yourself, freedom to connect to mystery, something bigger. And so in my family, on my mother's side, she was a kind of activist wannabe. She did what activism that she could under the kind of brutal regime of my father. And there was something in it about her care for the world. People think that meditation is some kind of passive thing, but I actually think that it centers you and it gives you a kind of courage so that you can go out and not let the terror that's out there colonize your heart, because we need that now. You don't want to take in the toxic terror of the world around us, but rather, as Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh says, when the crowded Vietnamese refugee boats met with storms or pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. But if even one person on the boat remained centered and calm, it was enough. They showed the way for everyone to survive. And so you become that person on the boat of this earth or the boat of this society. And then how do you do it? You do it both from a place of centeredness and a sense of connection or respect for everyone. And then you asked about happiness. So this is from Molly Ivins, you know, who is a New York Times columnist and humorist and activist. And she says, so keep fighting for freedom and justice, beloveds, but don't forget to have fun doing it. Be outrageous. Rejoice in all the oddities that freedom can produce. And when you get through celebrating the sheer joy of a good fight, be sure to tell those who come after how much fun it was. So that whether it's spiritual practice or activism, it's not a grim duty. It is your planting of the most creative, artistic, beautiful seeds and standing up for the things that matter, but doing it with a heart that actually demonstrates what you want the world to be. And so we talk about both sides in this book, both of quieting the mind and tending the heart, and then what it means to bring yourself to the world that so needs it. Oh, look at that little baby. Hi. How great. Wonderful. You are welcome. Your first Dharma talk. All right. Go for it. It's the new Buddha. A month or two ago, whenever it was, I went with my daughter, who's an asylum lawyer here, and sort of her work is to help folks whose lives are in danger from around the world get asylum. You know, her clients are people who are fleeing gang violence, or imagine a gay guy from Uganda who would be stoned to death if he was sent back, or a transgender woman from Saudi Arabia who came to Mecca, otherwise known as San Francisco, right? Or whatever. But anyway, we went down to the airport. that weekend when the first presidential decree was to block people coming in from the majority Muslim countries, and there were all those people stuck in the airport. And she and a whole bunch of other young lawyers went down. There was 1,500, 2,000 people there in the international terminal. And there were many more lawyers than detained people, which was great. There was this whole team, you know, okay, anybody else need legal help for immigration? It was beautiful. So there'd be 300 people here and 400 there with their signs at different gates and kind of picketing and chanting and so forth. No ban, no fear, refugees are welcome here and so forth. All right, good. The best part was one gate where they were chanting like that. In the middle of 300 or 400 people was a New Orleans jazz band. So people would be chanting, no ban, no fear, and then the drummer would kick in with the rhythm behind, and they'd sing, refugees are welcome here, and then the sax would do a little riff, and the trumpet would come in, and pretty soon they were chanting and singing with this great kind of music behind it. The cops were smiling. I mean, it was artful protest. It wasn't we're against you, we're for something that's more beautiful, and you have to remember what it is.
The great thing about interviewing Jack, you only need one question.
It goes on and on and on, on and on. You were going to read something new book.
I still want to read something, but there's still some things I'd like to probe a little deeper into. And that one is the Jewish connection, because it's so extreme. It's so. The first big meditation retreat center, and which you co-founded.
Cornfield, Goldstein.
Salzberg, and Schwartz.
Right, a law firm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you have any theory, any, I mean, there's...
No, I'm only Jewish on my parents' side, I'm sorry.
There's suffering, which is kind of...
That's just very Jewish, right?
Yeah, very Jewish.
Along with the food, yes.
How have you've been meditating for 45 years. What has been the most difficult part of your spiritual journey? Where were the big rocks on the path? What was the thing that you had to overcome that was most difficult for you?
Oh, there have been all kinds of things. Physical illness at some points that was pretty difficult. About 6 or 7 years ago, I think it was, I was teaching in front of a whole group of people, and I fell over, and I was unconscious for a long time, for a minute or more, and when I finally came to, there were like 7 doctors all peering down at me to see if I was still living or whatever. And then I started having a lot of tremors and weird things happening in my body. And it was getting worse and worse, getting dizzier and about to pass out. And I had all the tests they can do, MRIs and, you know, CT scans and all the kinds of things like that. I couldn't quite figure out what was going on. And as it progressed, fortunately it's better now, but... I went to see this neurologist. I went in, and he misdiagnosed me. And he said, you have this genetic condition, which in fact is partly true, it's partly correct. And he said, and the way it looks like you're going to be, your body is going to continue, because it was sort of deteriorating over these next months, worse and worse, so that you lose a lot of your physical capacities, and with it comes dementia. And I thought I was cool with death. I'd been a monk sitting in the charnel grounds when the bodies were there being burned and meditating on birth and death, and we're not this physical body, and done all these kind of trainings and practices. But I got surprisingly frightened. I was talking to Ram Dass about it. He said, oh yeah, I flunked the course a few times like that, right? because dementia, rapid dementia and physical decline was just not my idea of how I was going to make an act. I thought about something a little cheerier than that or something. But anyway, but it taught me something also. And I did a dialogue not that long ago with a friend, Frank Ostaseski, who started Zen Center Hospice. And when he had a heart attack, and he'd sat with 2,000 people dying, he said, "Oh, I know how to do this." He was surprised. He said, "Wait a second, it's me now. It's not all these other people." That it wasn't quite as clear-cut and easy as he expected. And what I see in this and you have a nice mantra when you teach, Wes. His mantra is, "It's only human." That we have all these things. And the point isn't so much, again, to make oneself different, but to hold your own life and the life of others around you with spaciousness and compassion and love, and say, yeah, sometimes you get afraid. And that's okay, that's just fear. It's not, and then as you practice more, you say, okay, this is just fear, and this is the judging mind, thank you for your opinion. You know, I'm okay for now, thanks for trying to protect me, but I'm doing all right, and don't need that judgment right now, thank you. This is sadness, and this is joy, thank you. You can kind of bow to the different states that come, but there's some way in which who you are is so much bigger than that. And life has these different layers. I remember when I came back from living in the monastery and been doing all these long retreats and trainings for some years. And I came back, and it was in the first month of back being a layperson and driving. I was driving on the Massachusetts Thruway, the equivalent of freeway, and a semi-trailer in front of me lost part of a tire and smashed into another car, and that crashed, and all these cars were starting to pile up, and I screeched on my brakes. I was so calm. It was like equanimity. I'd been meditating in this way, and this time facing death, very, very calm and peaceful. Yeah. But my body grabbed the steering wheel and wrenched it around and pulled over in the grass. And it was like there were two things going on. One says, "Oh, well, maybe I'm going to die. That's okay. Here we are." And my body says, "No, you're not. Not right now." You know. And all the adrenaline came and kind of wrenched the car around. And because I was so quiet, I was able to witness that these are just the different dimensions of our being. And they are the way they are. This is what human incarnation is like.
There seems to be a great hunger in our country and in the Western world right now for some kind of palliative, some kind of cure, some kind of spiritual renewal. I Googled mindfulness the other day. There were like 30 million references. A decade ago, nobody knew what the word mindfulness was or meant or had any familiarity with it at all.
Would you Google justice, please?
Do you think that the Dharma is arriving in time, or arriving to fulfill that need? There's so much activity now in meditation groups at every city in America, and that it feels like, you know, there's a revolution going on in our understanding of ourselves and our desire to understand ourselves. Maybe because we feel the threat of extinction or the condition of the planet, but there's a hunger that you're feeding.
Well, first I'd say that there is a seed of awakening in everyone. There's a possibility of awakening, and that each child born has a spirit of innocence and beauty, and all kinds of things can happen to condition us, and trauma and ways that make us both frightened and hurt and angry and hateful and all of those kind of things. But underneath it, I basically believe that, and have felt that consciousness itself is pure. And that there's some way in which, in a culture that's as materialistically wealthy and so forth as we are, that there's a really deep longing for something more. And that something more expresses itself in different ways. It might be in, you know, fundamentalist religion in some way, but underneath that is also a longing for connection. You know, it might be in a lot of different forms. And as we are right now, it's very clear that no amount of outer technology, computers, World Wide Web, internet, nanotechnology, biotechnology, space technology, all these things, you know, where you have the great library of Alexandria in your smartphone in your pocket, and all the bad movies that were ever made too, that no amount of science and technology is going to stop continuing warfare. It's not going to stop continuing racism. It's not going to stop continuing environmental destruction and tribalism and the things that are making the suffering of the world grow. That the outer developments of humanity now are requiring us as a species to cultivate and develop the inner maturity, the inner capacity to match that outer power, if you will. As one chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, we are a nation of nuclear giants and ethical infants. And so, in a way, to answer your question, I think this is the calling for humanity at this point, and that tools such as the trainings of mindfulness and compassion and empathy and understanding, which are, people think of them as weakness, you know, I'm going to be mindful, it's passive, I'll be loving, you know, that's nothing. But love is the only power that can meet violence and match it. You know, when mothers lift cars off their children, or when Martin Luther King says after the church is bombed and all the, you know, suffering and the children were killed, and he says, we will meet your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering, and we will not hate you, but we will soon wear you down by our compassion and our willingness to face what has happened. And we will wear you down so much that by winning our freedom, we will somehow touch your heart and win your freedom as well. This isn't passive. This is a kind of power that is the only thing that's truly an antidote. And anyway, I could go on, but you.
I'd like to offer a chance for people here to ask Jack a question. Let me just say that this book is wonderful, full of really inspirational stories from individuals, and it's ecumenical. It's not a Buddhist book. It's just a wise book, full of wisdom. I wanted to read a little passage from it. Is there one that you were
go for it
angling to
see
read?
What you pick.
If you
see
want.
What you pick.
There's some beautiful passages in here that read like poetry. Open to the mystery. Live in mystery. It's one of the later chapters. This is actually a guided meditation. Ask yourself, how did you get here in this human life? What is mind? What is love? What will happen next month? When will you die? What is death? Where do stars come from? What will the human world look like in 25 years? Pause after each question and let the feeling of don't know open you to mystery. Relax and enjoy the mystery. Rest in the vast mystery that holds and supports you and all life. You are the mystery seeing itself.
Who wrote that? The mystery wrote it. I'll read you a story. A friend of mine, because in this book, again, talking about the freedom of forgiveness, the freedom of starting over, the courage of freedom to love anyway, to bring compassion and justice together in your actions. My friend Maladoma Somay, who's a West African shaman and medicine man with a couple of PhDs on the side, said that for the Dogara people in West Africa, it said that if you understand when a person is born, they each come in, I love this metaphor, each human being arrives with a certain cargo, is his word. I can think of all those little boats on the West African rivers. And your task in this life is to deliver your cargo, to bring the particular gifts that you have to offer this world. So here's a story for you. And it's from Puanani Burgess, who is a Hawaiian educator. She says, I help people talk to each other and to build the beloved community, which I believe is Martin Luther King's phrase. And here's the practice I use. I ask him to tell three stories. The first is the story of all your names. The second is the story of your community. And the third story I ask them to tell is the story of your gift. One time I did this process with a group in our local high school. We went around the circle and got to this young man, Kele, and he told the story of his names well and the story of his community well. But when it came time to tell the story of his gift, he asked, "What, miss? What kind of gift you think I have? I'm put in this special ed class. I have a hard time. I can't read. I can't do math. Why you make me ashamed for ask that kind of question? What kind of gift you have? If I had gift, you think I'd be here?" The boy shut down and shut up, and I felt really shamed, for it was never my purpose to shame anyone. 2 weeks later, I'm in our local grocery store, and I see him at the end of one of those aisles down there, and I think, oh, I've hurt him so much, I better turn around and not even, you know, go that way. And as I'm turning around, he turns around and sees me and throws his arms open and says, Auntie, I've been thinking about you, you know. 2 weeks I've been thinking, what my gift? I say, okay, brother, what's your gift? He says, you know, I've been thinking, I cannot do that math, and I can't read so good. But Auntie, when I stay in the ocean, I can call the fish. And the fish, he come every time. And every time when my family is hungry, I can put fish on the table. Every time. And sometime when I stay in the ocean and the shark, he come, and he look at me, and I look at him, and I tell him, Uncle, I'm not going to take plenty fish. I'm just going to take 1-2 fish just for my family. All the rest I leave for you. And so the shark, he say, oh, you cool, brother. And I tell the shark, Uncle, you cool. And the shark, he go his way and I go mine. And I look at this boy and I know what a genius he is. But in our society, the way schools are run, he's rubbish. He's not appreciated. So when I talk to his teacher and the principal, I asked them, what would his life have been if the curriculum were gift-based? What if we were able to see that each person in our community, each person in the web of our life has a gift to offer? So that's part of the chapter of the freedom to give your gift.
So beautiful.
So you wanted a question, huh?
Yeah.
I'm not going to have much time to sign books because I have to make a plane, but questions better. Let's do a couple questions.
You're going to do it.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm sitting and, you know, in a timeless kind of peaceful moment, and then the mind interferes. And I try to grasp it. Actually, at first I try to focus, then I try to do some other things, then I'm grasping at it, and all of a sudden that peacefulness, that wonderful feeling goes down like water going out a drain. And I can continue to sit, but I can never get it back. I'd have to get up and do some mundane things, like you say, do whites in the laundry or something like that, and then I can come back. How can I try to stay in that point and let that, whatever it is, wash over me without the focus, the grasping of it?
So it's a beautiful and important question, and I appreciate it. And also, I appreciate the intelligence and mindfulness that's been observing this whole process. I get peaceful, I have this loving open space or this quiet place, but then the mind, which has no pride, by the way, it just comes in and it starts thinking about other things and tasks and so forth, and then all of a sudden that starts to go, and then you kind of want that peacefulness to stay, but it doesn't, and
so
forth.
Sounds like my mind. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
So there's a different way to understand this, and that is that there's the peacefulness of a peaceful state, and when it comes, it's really lovely, and we need it, and it kind of recalibrates our body and our psyche and our cells. So to have that come is a great gift. But the idea in mindfulness and compassion practice is not to have any particular state at all as the goal. So what I mean is this. Suppose you sit and you get very peaceful, and then you get filled with love and your heart opens and you just love the people around you in the world, and your heart's like, oh, so wide and so loving, and I just want to keep it this way. Oh, I want to be this way all the time. I'm sort of exaggerating. Excuse me. Oh, just keep it like this. But you can't, because just as the body breathes and the heart pumps, and the cerebral spinal fluid moves, and the phases of the moon and the tides and the menstrual cycles and the stock market, all of that, you know, go through their cycles. The heart opens and closes too, sometimes like a poppy out there in the fields, sometimes loving and sometimes it needs to kind of close in on itself. And the mind will open and be spacious and vast. And then sometimes you notice, oh, now it's closing and now it's doing to-do lists. And you become the compassionate witness, the loving awareness. This is really what you are. This is what spirit is. You are loving awareness. And you say, well, I had the gift of 15 minutes of it being peaceful. My body feels so good. And now it looks like it's the shopping list meditation, you know, or to-do list meditation. And you notice that. And if you don't resist it and you don't try to get back to that other thing, then you discover a different kind of peace, which is the ability to be just where you are. I think it says no time like the present, right where you are, and say this too, like you could bow to it. And even that becomes okay. So that's, thank you for that beautiful question. Take another one.
I want to thank you for all of your work. It's been very inspiring. But one thing that I've really grappled with a lot is about the inequalities that we obviously are come to in this world. And one of those is this economic inequality and the injustice and pain and suffering that goes on with that. And somehow it's been very difficult to transfer your message to people who are experiencing this suffering. And how do you tackle this problem?
I think, thank you for that beautiful question. I think it was Gandhi said, for those who are hungry, God comes in the form of bread. You know, that that you can't only talk about the mystery and spirit when there is hunger, when there is economic injustice, when there's trauma and there's suffering. On the other hand, you don't want to leave it out. You actually need both. And, you know, when I've been in refugee camps and in places where there have been tremendous trauma, there are two parts. One is you have to do what you can to feed people, to love them, to somehow work, whether it's politically or economically, to bring justice. But you also have to remember the dimension of spirit and love to see that in all those people that you think you want to help, actually, there is an inherent dignity and a beauty to their spirit, and that feeds them as well. So I can't divide them anymore in some way. I'll tell you one story, and maybe it'll be the last one, because I have to make my plane, and I'll sign a few books anyway. And it's one that really affected my life a lot. One of my dearest friends and colleagues and a teacher of mine was a man named Mahagosananda, who was the Gandhi of Cambodia. And we lived together in forest monasteries during the first years of the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian Holocaust genocide, where more than 2 million people were killed in a very small country. And because he was one of the few senior monks remaining, when he could, he went to the refugee camps on the border of people who'd fled, Khao Dung and Sakeo, a number of these camps. All 19 members of his family had been killed. His temple was burned. People had been starved, people had been shot, and so forth. And when we were in the camp, he was sort of going around and ministering to people. He spoke 15 languages and had a PhD, and he was a kind of very erudite scholar, but mostly he was just a ball of love, basically. And then he said, we should have a temple here, because their temples were burned, and they fled, and they've lost all this. And the UNHCR gave us permission to build a little temple in the middle of the square in the center of the camp. Tin roof, platform, an altar, Buddha, and so forth. The Khmer Rouge underground in the camp said, anybody who goes to that temple, when we get out of here, you will be shot. So the day to open it, we went through the camp bringing a big gong to see if anyone would come. And 25,000 people filled the square. And there he was. He sat up in his bright orange robes, this man who'd lost so much, his whole family and all of his community. And being there with him, you look out and see the sea of faces, and there were the faces of trauma and loss. Not only people who hadn't enough to eat, but people who'd watched the killing of people in their own family and community. It was, so there'd be an uncle and, you know, two nieces, that was all that was left, or a grandmother and, you know, a couple of the grandchildren. And I thought, all right, what can he say? What can he say to people who've suffered in this magnitude? And he put his hands together, and he began to chant in Cambodian and in Sanskrit or Pali, the ancient language, one of the first verses from the Buddhist text that goes, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. And he chanted it, and he started to chant it over and over. And first, it had been years since they were allowed to hear their sacred chants, and people began to weep just hearing him chant this. And then they started to chant with him. And after a while, 25,000 people were singing and chanting, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. And it was as if he spoke a truth that was even bigger than the sufferings of those who sat there. He spent most of the rest of years of his life, he went to the UN to help the peace negotiations, and there were all these temples built, but he spent most of the last years of his life leading people from the camps back to their villages. And he said, you can't ride in a bus or in the back of a truck as you might, so forth. You have to walk, and you have to reclaim your land with every step. And so he'd be in the front of a line of 300 or 500 people, you know, ringing a bell and chanting. And they'd walk the 100 miles back to their village, chanting loving kindness prayers for every step. He said we have to reclaim and re-imbue this land with who we really are. And that's what he did for years and years. So there's no way to divide the bread and economic injustice and so forth. One has to respond to that. I mean, this is, it's us, it's our family. Mother Teresa says, the problem with you is you draw your family circle too small. This is our family. And at the same time, you also have to recognize the inviolable spirit that is born into a human being. It's not just about feeding their body or getting money, but it's also feeding their heart. So thank you for that moving and beautiful question.
Great spiritual teacher, Jack. It's just beautiful to hear what you have to say and how you have to say it.
The book, I don't know about the great spiritual teacher part.
All right.
You should talk to my daughter. She'll straighten you out.
Okay. I should know. No Time Like the Present, the new book. Are you going to be signing here?
I'll sign a few of them, but then I have to make a plane. I'm signing it in your imagination.
I'm supposed to acknowledge all sponsors. I'd like to thank the Bank of the World.
The Bank of the World. I like that. That's a lot better than the Bank of America. Thank you.
It says
hallelujah.
It says
the Bank of the People. This is
what it says, the Bank of the World and Susie's Dog Parlor.
That's my previous book, After the Ecstasy, The Dog Laundry, or something like that. Yeah. Thank you all for coming. It was really a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.